I'm David Garland. This is Spinning on Air, bringing you Connie Converse, Walking in the Dark. This was first heard on WNYC Radio in 2009, and it got a really strong response from listeners. Listeners maybe like you, who hadn't known anything about Connie Converse, but who found her story to be very moving. I'm glad to be able to bring this to you as a podcast, because Connie's story is one that's worth listening to closely. It's the story of a life, it's the story of a woman, it's some wonderful songs, and it's a poignant mystery as well. Recently, I was asked to write some liner notes for an album of Connie Converse songs performed by a variety of people that John Zorn's Zodic label is putting out. I took it as an occasion to look at some aspects of Connie's life that I didn't cover closely in this original program. So I want you to know Connie's story from the angles presented in this episode, and I'm going to follow it soon with another episode that focuses on parts of Connie's life that I haven't seen covered anywhere else, things which add a very interesting new dimension to her story. So that will come soon, but what comes right now is Connie Converse, Walking in the Dark.
This one is called One by One.
When did you do this?
This I did about 3 o'clock one morning about six weeks ago. We go walking in the dark. We go walking out at night, and it's not as lovers go. It's one by one by one in the dark.
I had never heard of Connie Converse. I've hosted a program called Spinning on Air here in New York City for over 20 years. I've encountered hundreds of songwriters and musicians fallen under the spell of music that I've heard and the people who've made it. And I've amassed thousands of records and CDs and played them on the air. But Connie Converse had completely eluded me. Eluded me until Gene Deitch joined me on my radio program in January of 2004. He brought along some exuberant jazz, some lively blues, some great recordings that he shared with us on the program. Among them was a song that really stood out for me, because it was so quiet, because its intensity was subdued, because the song itself was so powerful and the singer so personal. The performer of that song was Connie Converse. Over the next hour, we're going to explore the music of this woman who might be considered the very first American singer-songwriter. I'll also tell you what we know about her life here in New York when she wrote these songs during the 1950s. And we'll try to understand why one day in 1974, Connie Converse packed up her belongings into a Volkswagen Bug, drove away, and was never seen or heard from again. Let's begin with a song that goes by a couple different titles. Connie's music was never commercially released, so she didn't have to resolve her titles if she didn't want to. This one's sometimes referred to as Talkin' Like You, at other times as Two Tall Mountains, and at still other times as That Squirrel Thing. Here's Connie Converse, a witty, independent, wonderfully creative woman, a home recording she made in the 1950s.
In between two tall mountains, there's a place they call Lonesome. Don't see why they call it lonesome. I'm never lonesome when I go there. See that bird sitting on my windowsill? Well, he's saying whippoorwill all the night through. see that brook running by my kitchen door? Well, it couldn't talk no more if it was you. Up that tree, there's sort of a squirrel thing. Sounds just like we did when we were quarreling. In the yard, I keep a pig or two. They drop in for dinner like you used to do. I don't stand in the need of company with everything I see talking like you. Up that tree, there's sort of a squirrel thing. Sounds just like we did when we were quarreling. You may think you left me all alone, but I can hear you talk without a telephone. I don't stand in the need of company with everything I see talking like you. See that bird sitting on my windowsill? Well, he's saying whippoorwill all the night through. Just whippoorwill all the night through. In between two tall mountains there's a place they call Lonesome. Don't see why they call it lonesome. I'm never lonesome now I live there.
Connie Converse, recorded in 1954. I'm sure you noticed the structure of that song began with that sort of angular, almost maybe Hoagie Carmichael-influenced introduction that kind of set the scene for what seemed to be perhaps a melancholy song. And then the narrator, the singer, was cheerfully rejecting someone, sending them out of her life and being happy to be on her own. Not something that many women were singing back in the 1950s. Connie Converse was many things before her time. She was an independent woman, a very intelligent woman who was a feminist and who expressed her intelligence and her independence in her songs. She also expressed her humanity, often a little bit obliquely and sometimes with heartbreaking directness. Here's another song by Connie Converse. It's called How Sad, How Lovely, a song that she recorded a few times, always privately, and not a commercial recording. And apparently before she made this recording, there's a little note accompanying it saying that at the last moment she added a couple verses. And it's a lovely thing, sort of watching the world from a slight distance.
How sad, how lovely, how short.
Looking for the first.
like light, like your smile, like the fall of a leaf. How sad, how lovely, how brief.
A song written and performed over 50 years ago, How Sad, How Lovely. It's a piece by Connie Converse. Here's Connie again singing another of her songs, Roving Woman, expressing an attitude of independence and glee that might have been a little unusual coming from a woman in the 1950s. Along with Connie and her guitar, she's accompanying herself, is what sounds like a Siamese cat who joins her about halfway through this song, and Connie seems to enjoy that.
People say a roving woman is likely not to be better than she ought to be. So when I stray away from where I've got to be, someone always takes me home. A lady never should habituate saloons, and that is where I find myself on many afternoons. But just as I begin to blow away the foam, someone tips his hat to me and takes me home. People say a gambling woman is likely not to be better than she ought to be. So when I stray away from where I've got to be, someone always takes me home. Now poker is a game a lady shouldn't play, and every floating poker game just seems to float my way. But long before I've lost a thing besides my comb, someone tips his hand to me and takes me home. Don't see why they always do it. My can't be vanity, must be sheer humanity. When some kind soul remarks with great urbanity, lady, let me take you home. Of course, there's bound to be some little aftermath that makes a pleasant ending for the straight and narrow path. And as I go to sleep, I cannot help but think how glad I am that I was saved from cards and drink. People say a roving woman is likely not to be better than she ought to be. So when I stray, there's positively got to be someone there to take me home.
I think that's a perfect background, excuse me.
Connie Converse, voice and guitar, and a cat, adding a couple extra meows to Roving Woman, a song by Connie Converse. She not only sings and plays these songs, she was the lyricist. And as I hope you're getting a chance to hear, the lyrics can be surprising, they can be clever, they can be smart, they can be very poignant, as we'll hear particularly in some songs coming up. And they express in Connie's particular way her feelings about the world and her place in it, and a sense at times of alienation and melancholy. A lot of these recordings were made on a reel-to-reel tape deck by Gene Deitch. Gene Deitch is a cartoonist and animator, one of the creators of the cartoon Tom Terrific. He worked on Mr. Magoo, ran the UPA animation studio for a while, and is the director of the Oscar-winning 1961 animated short Monroe, written by Jules Pfeiffer. He's been living in Prague in the Czech Republic since about 1959, but knew Connie Converse in New York City through his friend Bill Bernal, who Gene says was a very enthusiastic guy, always turning him on to new things. And it was Mr. Bernal who coaxed Gene into inviting Connie Converse to his home in Hastings-on-Hudson, just north of New York City, where they would have occasional gatherings, some of Gene Deitch's friends and musicians who would come to be recorded on this newfangled tape recorder that Gene Deitch had and loved to use. We spoke to Gene Deitch on the phone from Prague. He remembered these sessions.
I sat her up on a little stool, sort of a kitchen stool, which she liked to sit on when she was playing, and put my microphone in front of her, and she just started to sing, and we maybe would ask a couple of words or make a few remarks in between songs, but then she just sang one song after another. She was not really good looking. I mean, that is not beautiful. She was pleasant looking. She wore glasses, and you know, I had the immediate impression when I saw her that this is the type of person who you usually see as a nun. You know, but then when she started singing, you realize she was anything but a nun, because she obviously had a lot of interesting experiences which were very thinly masked in her songs. I just had the feeling that all of the songs she sang were in one way or another about herself, her frustrations, whether they were funny songs or ironic songs or beautiful lyric songs, they all had a very strong personal subtext.
This letter comes from Fortune's child. You see no other.
Fortune's Child. During his May 1954 recording session with her, Gene Deitch attempted to interview a shy Connie Converse.
Well, she exuded an atmosphere of tremendous intelligence, and it was a little bit kind of frightening to talk with her, because if I started asking her questions, because when she started singing these songs, and naturally everybody, all of our guests who met her at the time, wanted to know all about her. But I felt like if I started asking questions, I was going to sound like a radio or TV interviewer or something. And she would sort of snicker a little bit at my questions, because she was so obviously intelligent and brilliant that it was really difficult to speak with her without sounding like an idiot.
Well, how did you get started writing songs?
Well, I always did hum things to myself, and when I got the guitar, I was picking up folk songs and then started to make my own little tunes and words.
How long ago was that?
Oh, about 4 or 5 years ago.
And how many songs have you written?
Oh, about 25 or so.
Voice of Connie Converse. You heard her in conversation with Gene Deitch, recorded in May of 1954. There are things we know, and a lot of things we don't know, about Connie Converse. For example, we don't know if she ever had a romantic relationship. She didn't get married, and when she disappeared in 1974, she didn't leave behind any love letters. Did she never make herself available to love? Did love never find her? We don't even know her sexual orientation. Maybe she felt compelled to keep secrets back in the mid-20th century. Her songs were often about loneliness. We do know that Elizabeth Connie Converse was born August 3, 1924, in New Hampshire. Her father was a strict Baptist minister. Her mother was musical. Connie and her two brothers had to create their own entertainment, and her younger brother, Philip, remembers with a lot of affection the childhood games and activities that Connie would endlessly invent. Connie excelled and won prizes in high school, and then a full scholarship to Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. After 2 years, she dropped out. Along with a few tapes of her songs, Connie Converse left behind a very carefully organized filing cabinet that was locked for several decades and only recently reopened by her brother Philip Converse. In it are found some typed-up journal entries, a number of poems, a few letters, and other fascinating remnants of Connie Converse's intellectual and emotional life. Here's a poem that Connie wrote when she was 20 years old in 1944, in which she seems to refer to herself as a drowned and living trumpet. We'll hear it read by Amber Benson.
Ask me who made the world. Ask me who made the world. I will avert my eyes and laugh. I will clap sudden fingers to my lips and turn to someone else. While you lean forward, trying to understand the muffled shouting of my mind. Notes from a drowned and living trumpet. Elizabeth Converse.
Also found in the file cabinet is a journal entry from several years later, showing Connie's awareness of moral ambiguity and a sense of alienation.
When I was a child, sitting in church, I used to look around at the solemnity of faces and think that everybody must know some great thing that they had neglected to tell me, even though I had been to Sunday school and day school and all that. Nothing that I had learned in those schools or at home could account for me, for these reverent and ceremonious adult behaviors. The surface of these behaviors had such a uniform gloss to it. To use the old childhood jeer, I thought I must have got dropped on my head as an infant, and some of the marbles fell out and rolled under the crib. So, you see, I did not always generalize from my difficulties. It took a long time for me to find out that the uniform gloss and the great secret, both of them cherished by stable subcultures, tended to serve as lids on underlying conflicts and disagreements, and that people who publicly believe in God can still wither in private despair, or suck the blood of their neighbors, or sell their souls to the devil.
I think a lot of the power of Connie Converse's songs comes from their thoughtful introspection, but she really enjoyed writing funny songs as well, and wrote quite a few. And a very upbeat one that she wrote is called Down This Road. We can go go back to Gene Deitch's recording made in May of 1954 in Hastings-on-Hudson, and they speak of that piece.
Tell us about Down This Road, because that was the first song you wrote, wasn't it?
As I told you, I had sort of half, I'd hummed things until I got to the point where I think, well, that's a tune that I made up, but it was never polished off or words
finally,
put to it or anything.
You're just humming tunes and finally you realize that you had written something.
Yes, more or less.
Down this road on a Monday morning came a riding three strangers. Down this road on a Monday morning came a riding three strangers. There was one wearing green and one a peacock feather and one wearing overshoes against the wintry weather. And they gave me 6 white horses for to carry my load, and they beckoned me to follow, and they took me down this road. On a Monday morning came a riding 3 strangers. Down this road on a Monday morning came a riding 3 strangers. There was one wearing green and one a peacock feather and one wearing overshoes against the wintry weather. And they gave me 6 white horses for to carry my load, and they beckoned me to follow, and they took me down this road. La 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 la, la 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 la, la la.
Connie Converse singing the first song she wrote probably in 1950. She subtitled it in a note to her brother, A Monday Morning Dream of a Clerk Typist. A kind of bouncy, almost traditional folk song sounding piece. And a couple years later, Connie was a bit of an experimentalist, and she liked to go back to these things and find new dimensions in them. And she created sort of a descant or counterpoint vocal line to the second verse of Down This Road. And it's a lovely little perky melody, but just recently I listened closely to what the words are, and they give another dimension to this song. Almost any day when I'm weary, almost any day when I'm blue, I want to take a train and ride it, or dig a hole and crawl inside it. Almost any day when I'm weary, almost any day when I'm blue, it's surprising, realizing what a little bit of dreaming will do. Almost any day when I'm blue.
And they took me down this road.
Almost any day when
I'm morning came a riding.
Almost any day
three strangers down this road.
Almost any day
on a Monday morning. Came a riding
almost any day
three strangers. There was one
I
wearing
take green a train
and one a peacock feather and one wearing overshoes against the wintry weather. And they gave me
almost any day
6 white horses for to carry
almost any day
my load. And they beckoned
it's surprising
me to follow,
realizing
and they took me
bit of
I think the way she used that bouncy melody and placed in it these strange and poignant words, I want to take a train and ride it or dig a hole and crawl inside it, is really typical of Connie Converse. I feel she's a particular kind of artist. She's not the only example of this. I think it's one reason that people have for becoming artists. Some people are big and boisterous and larger than life and spread their personality everywhere they go. And there's that kind of artist. But then there's the other kind, the Connie Converse kind. People who are feeling things deeply but are very private people at the same time. Connie Converse was a craftswoman in the way she put her songs together. She was very interested in unusual changes and modulations of melody, unusual chordal accompaniments. Her guitar parts are technically rather complicated. And so she was very very drawn into the details of creating songs, rhyming the words in an intricate and effective way, putting them to the right kind of melody, creating the appropriate accompaniment. And this is where a lot of her energy went. And because her energy was engaged in the details of the creative process, I think it let her heart come out in a way that she might not have been able to do more directly. I think of her as being, you know, like someone who is working on a large sort of billboard-size painting that has some words on it, and she's intricately involved in the spacing of the words and the coloring of the foreground and background, the elegance of the typography, and she makes it just so. When the viewer stands back from this sign, you see that it's not just color and texture and form, but it has a message. It says something, perhaps even something desperate, like, "Help me, I'm lonely." Here's one of Connie's songs called "The Witch and the Wizard." And in fact, it does involve a witch and a wizard and a little elf. But hidden in there is a pretty vivid description of a marriage made in hell.
A witch there was, and a wizard as well, moved into a rose-covered cottage in hell, a rose-covered cottage in hell. The wizard, in spite of his wizardly eyes, didn't know he had married a witch in disguise. He thought her a very respectable maid, and hoped she would never discover his trade. The witch was not wanting in womanly wiles. She covered her bridegroom with ruffles and smiles. She only went witching on Saturday night, and hoped in between times it all would go right. Next day the witch bore the wizard an elf. So handsome he looked like the devil himself, and he was the devil himself. The wizard looked down at his son, surprised, saying, "None of my family has lavender eyes. I think for my honor there's only one course. I'll ask you to grant me an instant divorce." The witch was in tears, for she knew beyond doubt she certainly hadn't been gadding about. And now, since the baby had lavender eyes, she saw very clearly her husband's disguise. The devil looked up from his crib and he smiled. "Don't break up your home, you must think of your child. Remember your poor little child. A child," said the witch, "as is very well known, requires a mamma and papa of his own. Although you're a very contemptible man, I think we should both stick it out if we can." The wizard refused to acknowledge his son, but in dutiful deeds he would not be outdone by a wife who would waffle and put things to rights and stick to her knitting on Saturday nights. the witch settled down, and the wizard as well, and both began raising the devil in hell, in rage and vexation and tears. The witch can't stop witching, the wizard won't speak, and though they've been married for only a week, it seems like a thousand years.
The witch couldn't stop witching in Connie Converse's song The Witch and the Wizard. Connie, a feminist before her time, as well as a singer-songwriter before her time. We're listening to her recordings made in the 1950s of songs that she composed at that time. Connie singing and accompanying herself. And that's just about the only way that one can hear Connie's music. But I do know of one instance when someone else recorded a couple songs by Connie Converse. That someone else was Susan Reed, who was well-established in the 1950s and the early 60s as one of the leading female vocalists in the folk music scene, often accompanying herself on the Irish harp. She made several albums, and she gave a concert in New York City in which she included a set of songs by Connie Converse, and together with a tenor whose name we don't know at this point, she recorded a couple of these songs and sent them on tape to Connie, and we found this recording in that file cabinet. Sun Go Down, a song by Connie Converse, recorded by Susan Reed with another singer who I'm afraid I can't identify for you. And when Connie Converse disappeared in 1974, among the papers she left behind was a brief correspondence with Susan Reed. Susan Reed wrote to Connie with enthusiasm, saying, "I love these songs and I can't wait to play them for so-and-so, the recording executive I know, or maybe one of his friends, and I'm sure they're going to be interested." And as far as we know, if the record executive heard the songs, he simply said, "No thanks." A lot of Connie's friends treasured her songs, but when she tried to share them with the larger world, it seemed as though the answer she usually got was, No thanks. What's it feel like to craft these beautiful songs, so exquisitely made and so emotionally powerful, and to have them met with indifference? For Connie Converse, it seems perhaps she was devastated. By 1960, she'd left New York, giving up on her hopes of a career in music and as a songwriter. She moved to Michigan in 1960, but it seems as though that disappointment stayed with her and ultimately led to her 1974 disappearance. Connie left New York in 1960. Exactly why, we don't know. Surely it had something to do with her discouragement, her frustration, that her music was not of interest beyond her close circle of friends. She found her way to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where her brother Philip Converse lived with his wife Jean. He was just getting started in his association with the University of Michigan, and Connie quickly involved herself in the politics, the life, and the learning of the university. And before long, became the editor of an academic journal for the University of Michigan's Center for Conflict Resolution. Her restlessness continued, and she battled depression. Her friends and family wanted to help. Philip Converse.
In 1969, our mother organized a big trip to Alaska. Well, this was our mother worried about Connie, and in fact she wasn't married, and so on and so on. And Connie was horrified by this for two reasons. She was a heavy drinker and a heavy smoker, and she couldn't be on this trip. And and so she bore up.
But let me throw in what she told me. She said, you know, I want to go to Alaska like I want to go to the basement.
Well, the reason why I bring this up is that in the year or so before she disappeared, Mother had a new scheme for a new trip. And Connie didn't know how to say no, but it was horrifying to her. I've often thought that didn't help her in the late stages. I mean, one of the problems that disappearing would solve was she wouldn't have to take that trip.
Philip Converse and his wife Jean. Around 1971, when Connie seemed overwhelmed and depressed by her work editing the University of Michigan's Journal of the Center for Conflict Resolution, a group of friends were concerned. They wanted to give her a break from routine, so these friends and co-workers raised the money among themselves to finance a trip to England for Connie. In a letter thanking them, she speaks of her blue funk.
This spring, as some of you have known, I've been doubled up in a box called a blue funk and dilemma. I felt as if I were drowning in a sea of paper and obligations which I no longer had the energy to meet. I was deadly tired of doing careful, picky work on other people's manuscripts, which I have been doing a lot of in the past 25 years. My position at the center had allowed me to produce and publish a substantial manuscript of my own, but the work had had to be done largely as an extra, and toward the end of it, I got quite exasperated and discouraged. Furthermore, women of my age are very likely to get intimations of mortality that make them wonder whether there isn't something more and different that they'd like to do before reporting to the undertaker.
Amber Benson reading the words of Connie Converse. The song by Connie that was presented on Spinning on Air 5 years ago when Jean Deitch joined me and first exposed me to Connie's music was a piece called One by One. Connie wrote it in 1954, as she told Jean Deitch on the old tape, at 3 a.m. one morning. For me, it's Connie's most powerful song. It's her most personal, almost bleak, but very intimate, stark, and she just touches, in her simple, eloquent way, on something basic to us all, our need to reach out to one another.
We go walking in the dark. We go walking out at night. it's not as lovers go, two by two, to and fro, but it's one by one, one by one in the dark. We go walking out at night as we wander through the grass. We can hear each other pass, but we're far apart, far apart in the dark. So dark and tall, we are lost past recall. If the moon is down, and the moon is down, we are walking in the dark. If I had your hand, shine like the rising sun, like the sun.
In August 1974, Connie Converse turned 50 and then disappeared. Friends and family were heartbroken but not surprised. Connie sent farewell letters to the people she was closest to. Philip Converse.
Oh, these are horrifying letters. I mean, she's trying to explain herself, but she's really in bad shape. But her basic message to us was that she was having a hard time, and she really wanted to throw over the traces and go to some other place and try to start over again. This was the cover story. Yeah. We didn't believe it much. And toward the end, she said, well, who knows? Maybe 10 years from now, I'll be back on your doorstep.
She never did return, or she hasn't yet. Philip Converse tried to make sense of his sister's sudden disappearance. It led Philip Converse to consider some of the darker possibilities and to remember an incident from their childhood in New Hampshire.
One of her closest friends was a young lady named Frances Flint. And one day, Franny Flint committed suicide. And the community was in some uproar about this, very antagonistic to young Miss Frances Flint. How could she do such a thing, and so on. And Connie was upset about the community reaction to that. She and Frances Flint were in late high school at this point. And Connie absolutely declared one of the main rights of being a person is you have the right to do away with yourself if you feel you should do away with yourself. And I absorbed that ethic. Yeah. I didn't want Connie to think that I hadn't understood that message.
Yeah.
Despite wondering whatever happened to his sister, Philip Converse chose not to pursue her, but honored her choice to disappear.
Some of our friends, were constantly saying, well, aren't you pursuing her? What are you doing? And so on. We had a brother-in-law who wanted to use her Social Security to see if he was a lawyer and see if he couldn't trace her somehow. Oh, my mother. She was not a research person in any sense of the word. But she certainly, mother had friends that got into telephone books and,
did she?
And all that
this.
Sort of stuff. Yeah. And at one point, maybe a year or so later, somebody had a report that in a Kansas City phone book, there was an Elizabeth Converse. And I decided, well, I really should do something. And I located a tracer of lost persons to talk to about it. But he said, I have to tell you one thing that is very important. He said, if I were to go to Kansas City and find your sister, and she wanted to have nothing to do with you. The laws are steep. I just can't tell you about this.
Well, one has a right to become a missing person.
That's right. Mm. That's what it really amounts to.
Which I've never even thought of.
Yeah, I hadn't.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, right. After this Tracer of Lost Persons told me about these rights to disappear, I decided I didn't want him to pursue it.
Over the decades since her disappearance, Connie's brother Philip still sifts through the fragments of her past to try and understand why she left. He can only imagine what might have occurred.
There's a place called Tobermory, Ontario, which is a spit of land that juts up into Lake Huron, I guess it is. And I remember Connie telling me that one thing she always liked to do was to drive to the very tip of some, you know, where the land ends. And I think she wanted to drive up to Tobermory because she always wanted to go and see where the land ended. And when she disappeared, I thought, she's going to find some place where the land ends and she's going to drive off it.
We're going to conclude with a song by Connie Converse, written vividly from the point of view of depression. Sorrow Is My Name is the name of that song. But first, we're going to let Connie Converse say goodbye, the way she chose to say goodbye to her friends and family. Here's a reading of a draft for her farewell letter.
To anyone who ever asks if I'm long unheard from, this is the thin, hard sublayer under all the parting messages I'm likely to have sent. Let me go. Let me be if I can. Let me not be if I can't. For a number of years now, I've been the object of affectionate concern to my relatives and many friends in Ann Arbor. Have received not just financial, but spiritual support from them. Have made a number of efforts in this benign situation to get a new toehold on the lively world. Have failed. As an overeducated peasant, I've read a good bit about middle-aged depression and known several cases other than my own. I know there are temporary chemical therapies, and sometimes temporary is long enough. Experts agree it's not a single isolable mental disease. Probably it's a few simple humanities mixed up in a pot of random concomitant circumstances. In the months after I got back from my desperate flight to England, I began to realize that my new personal incompatibilities were still stubbornly hanging in. I did fight, but they hung in. Maybe my time in England, financed largely by my friends, was too benign a treatment. At any rate, it's the only sustained period in my life that I now look back on in the silliest detail as fun, unproductive fun, not getting anything done. I did sit in my bedsitter very often in bemused despair, but also I had fun. Since then I've watched the elegant, energetic people of Ann Arbor, those I know and those I don't know, going about their daily business on the streets and in the buildings, and I felt a detached admiration for their energy and elegance. If I ever was a member of this species, perhaps it was a social accident that has now been canceled. To survive it all, I expect I must drift back down through the other half, to the 20th, which I already know pretty well, to the 100th, which I have only read and heard about. I might survive there quite a few years, who knows, but you understand I have to do it by myself, with no benign umbrella. Human society fascinates me and awes me and fills me with grief and joy. I just can't find my place to plug into it. So let me go, please, and please accept my thanks for those happy times that each of you has given me over the years. And please know that I would have preferred to give you more than I ever did or could. I am in everyone's debt. Elizabeth Connie Converse.
Oh, keep on sleeping when I pass your door, and keep on hoping I will come no more. To me tomorrow will be all the same, for sorrow, sorrow is my name. Oh, keep on singing when you hear my feet, and keep on dreaming if your dream is sweet. And you may borrow candles for your game, but still your sorrow's coming just the same. And if you fear me, I will come in haste, and if you love me, I will go away, and if you scorn me, I will lay you waste, and if you know me, I will come to stay. So keep on singing when you hear my feet, and keep on dreaming.
Connie Converse, Walking in the Dark, was first heard in a slightly different form on WNYC Radio in 2009. It was written and produced by me, David Garland, and Rex Doan. Amber Benson read the words of Connie Converse. Thanks to Gene Deitch and to Philip and Gene Converse, and to Dan Zula and David Herman, who conducted the interview with Philip and Gene. After first hearing Connie's music on Spinning on Air, Dan and David produced an album of her songs called How Sad, How Lovely. It's on the Squirrel Thing label. I'm looking forward to the next episode of Spinning on Air, which is coming soon, and in which I will tell you more about the life of Connie Converse. Please tell your friends about the podcast. Go to spinningonair.org for more information. We have a newly launched Patreon page for the podcast. The link is there at spinningonair.org. And if you can donate there, you will help make this whole enterprise possible, because Spinning on Air is produced independently. The Spinning on Air name is a registered trademark of WNYC Radio, used by permission. Thanks for listening.